Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. If you're enjoying this podcast, please rate and review us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, whatever podcasting platform you use. Really helps spread word about the podcast and lets us continue to make interesting episodes for you. It's probably not an exaggeration to say there are few topics as taboo as that of human cannibalism. The idea of one human eating another human is almost unfathomable to most of us. Even when stories have surfaced of life and death situations where people were arguably forced to resort to cannibalism in order to survive, the act still raised many eyebrows in society at large. The preconception here is that cannibalism is widely viewed as abnormal. But how abnormal really is cannibalism? From an evolutionary and survival perspective, can the practice of cannibalism be better understood? How common has human cannibalism over the course of civilization been? And what have been the most common circumstances in which it developed? I'm joined today by Bill Schutt. Bill is an emeritus professor of biology at LIU Post and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. He wrote the book Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, which garnered widespread rave reviews from the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and elsewhere. His first book, Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures, was selected as Best Book of 2008 by Library Journal and Amazon, and was chosen for the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Program. He received his PhD in zoology from Cornell and held a postdoctoral fellowship at the AMNH, where he received a Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Grant. He's published over 24 peer-reviewed articles on topics ranging from terrestrial locomotion in vampire bats to the precarious arboreal copulatory behavior of a marsupial mouse. His research has been featured in Natural History, The New York Times, Newsday, The Economist, and Discovery. All right, Bill Schutt, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me on, Zale. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, we've been chatting back and forth for feels like a year almost. So I'm glad we got this on the books. I'm very excited to chat about it. And I think probably the first question that most people are wondering before we get into cannibalism is how you got into cannibalism, because it's such a niche, strange in many ways topic. But you've written this book and you're a world expert on it.
Yeah, I guess. I'm a zoologist, but I've also always had a deep interest in the macabre. And when I started my PhD at Cornell, I began working on vampire bats, and so the concept of blood-feeding creatures is something that I spent a lot of time doing. And And when I wrote my first book, that, you know, I got really lucky. I wound up with a wonderful agent, Elaine Markson, in New York City. And when we were looking for a topic for a book for me to write, initially it was going to be a book about vampire bats. But then we broadened it to look at vampirism and blood feeding across nature, and then into some aspects of it in humans. And so I found this interesting niche where I could take a topic like that and demystify it and try to make it entertaining. I think that comes from my teaching background. I was a college professor for 25 years, and I always wanted to sort of bring all my students along. I wasn't just interested in the fact that the smartest kids were getting it. And the way to do that was to give my lectures in interesting ways and give sometimes funny examples and things that would be memorable. So I found myself doing the same thing with vampirism and blood feeding. And so that became Dark Banquet. And then after that came out, there was a sort of, well, what's next? And to me, cannibalism was an obvious choice. And we came to it pretty quickly when I realized that, you know, there were really two different sets of books that were out there. And once again, one thing you're going to hear from me over and over again is just how lucky I've been to sort of step into some of this stuff. And there were these two different types of books. And one set was very academic. And these were books about cannibalism in specific animals that would appeal to the researchers that were working on those groups. And then on the other side of the coin, there was a bunch of kind of sensationalized garbage out there. And there were a couple of really decent books in between, but none of them covered the animal kingdom, and none of them, the animal kingdom and humans. So I thought, all right, well, this sounds cool. And so I jumped into it, and the result was a book about cannibalism. And I was really surprised, as I've mentioned before we started this interview, we were talking, I said that, you know, a lot of times I don't know, I'm not an expert on the field. And so that makes it so much more interesting, because the learning curve for me is really steep. And I think I try to impart that excitement that I feel when I'm working on something. You know, I'd never studied cannibalism before or cannibalistic animals. And so there were all of these surprises, and that's what made it really interesting for me. And I hope for the people who read the book.
As you said, demystifying is a very apt word, because I think there is a lot of preconceptions, misunderstandings, probably lore, fantasy about it, which there is in terms of movies that have been made. Obviously Hannibal was an extremely popular movie, but really what interests me about what you just said there the most is how you got onto it after studying how vampire bats are drinking blood. And that kind of is a natural segue to, okay, well, let's take that a step further to cannibalism. One of the core questions that comes to my mind when I think about this topic is cannibalism a normal phenomenon, so to speak, when you look at the animal kingdom? Is cannibalism this totally weird, strange thing, or is there something in our DNA or in evolution when you look across different animals and species that says, no, there is something actually natural about this thing that most of us would like to think is unnatural because it is so uncomfortable to talk about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And of course, as a zoologist, I started out and the book goes through the animal kingdom first. And that was one of the real big surprises. There were two huge surprises. One of them we can talk about later, and that has to do with humans. But in the animal kingdom, I was not aware, as many people were also not aware, that cannibalism in the animal kingdom is incredibly widespread for all sorts of reasons. Now, if you were to say animals that are cannibals, you think of black widow spiders and praying mantises. And that's what people thought for a long, long time. But when I got into this, what I started to realize was that there were a bunch of researchers who never really put their different species of study together, but they were working on all of these individual projects on cannibalism in the animal kingdom, you know, whatever they happened to be working on, whether it was fish or whether it was, you know, something in primates, but they never really put the big picture together. And so when I was able to kind of step back and look across all of the work that had been done, it just hit me right in the face that cannibalism is really, really widespread. And it's not just those weirdos, you know, quotation marks around weirdos, the black widow spiders and praying mantises, but it happens for a bunch of reasons the reason that cannibalism takes place in the animal kingdom, and this is sort of the old line about it, was that it, whenever you saw it, if it wasn't in those weirdos, then it had to do with stress. The animals are either starving or they are confined in captivity, and they're so stressed out that they consume their own kind. And so what I found was that it goes way beyond that. And cannibalism occurs for many, many, many different reasons. These are perfectly natural reasons.
And before you go through some of those reasons, I just want to clarify for the listeners and for myself, when we're talking about cannibalism in those examples or in these examples, are we talking about one animal eating the same species or eating the same type of animal? And also, does it refer to eating it alive, dead, or all-inclusive?
Yeah, I mean, there are people out there who may have a different take on the definition of cannibalism, but the one that I sort of developed over looking into the topic was that it's that cannibalism is the act of consuming all or part of another individual of the same species or a substantial part of him or herself. So I spoke to scientists who said, you know, well, if you're a camel and you're eating and you come across another dead camel and you're consuming then that's scavenging. It's not cannibalism. But I disagree. I think if you're consuming the same species, then that is a type of cannibalism.
Gotcha.
So reasons that in the animal kingdom that cannibalism occurs for naturally, parental care. As a life, as a hedge against unpredictable environmental conditions, as a reproductive strategy, and it just sort of went on, and there were all of these multiple examples across the animal kingdom. Very, very common in invertebrates, becomes less common when you get into the backboned animals, but still extremely frequent across probably thousands of species. And when you get into animals like the mammals and the primates, it is less frequent.
When you said a couple of examples there about taking care of your family, for example, or tending to kids, how would cannibalism help with that, just in terms of providing food for their kids?
I mean, do you want to get into some really strange examples?
Absolutely.
there's a legless amphibian that called a Sicilian, and that's with a C. My Italian relatives were like, what? What'd you say? And I'm like, that's not with an S, Grandpa. That's a C. And they are legless amphibians. And what they do is that when they were kept in captivity, they reported some really weird behavior. Like when the eggs hatched, the young would squirm all around their mother. And when they took a good hard look at it, what they realized was that the babies, the newly hatched young, were actually peeling the skin off their mothers and eating it. So they looked into this a little bit deeper, and they found that this is completely natural. And they wondered why when the female is about to lay its eggs, all of a sudden it puts on this really thick layer of fat on the outside of its body, or actually just underneath the skin. And they came to understand that this was, in a sense, a way that the young could be fed by their mother with this fat that had developed, this subcutaneous fat. So, I mean, there were all sorts of examples of that type of parental, you know. Then you'd have a spiders that would, spiders and arthropods, animals like crabs and lobsters that have their skeletons on their outside of their body. They go, you know, it's tough to grow when your skeleton's on the outside, so they molt. And that's why you see, for example, soft shell crabs. Soft shell crab is a crab that just molted its skin. It gets bigger and then its skin hardens on the outside. That's shell rather, not skin. So there are spiders that when their babies are born, they are, when they reach a certain size and they're still hanging out with their mother, the mother just sort of like hunkers down and allows them to consume her, you know, and then she dies, of course. But, you know, these are things that I didn't have a clue about, you know, and there were some examples that literally blew me away across the animal kingdom.
when you look at a lot of these examples, especially in invertebrates, which you said is more common, are more of them like this kind of survival type mechanism as opposed to more of a predatorial type? And I might be using the wrong words here because I'm not a zoologist, as you know, but as opposed to more of a predatorial where you see kind of, I don't know, a lion going after a lion, so to speak, or a lobster going after a lobster and killing it and then having cannibalism after that? Or are more of them for these other more kind of survivalist, well, obscure reasons?
That opens it up to the entire animal kingdom, not just invertebrates or vertebrates. So, for example, what would be a good example? As a reproductive strategy in animals like lions, if you think of the big cats, what they will do is if there is a new female that comes into the pride and she has a young cub with her, the lead lion in that pack will oftentimes kill and consume that cub so that the female comes into estrus sooner and is then receptive to his advances. So that's sort of like, you know, I guess I would class it as terminating maternal investment. So if you're not worried about your child, then you can then have a baby with the team leader. So that would be an example. To me, it wasn't always, or not even nearly all, about consuming, because there was not a lot of food. One of the most interesting examples that I found had to do with these with cannibalism that was triggered by unpredictable environmental conditions. In the American Southwest, in places like Arizona and New Mexico, there are toads called spadefoot toads. And when I was invited out there to work with the researchers who study these animals, they were like, oh yeah, well, they lay their eggs in ponds. And when I got to Arizona, I was expecting something you could, you know, take a jet ski out on. And what they were considering ponds, some of them were, you know, it looked like a Jeep spun out and then it filled with rainwater.
Disappointing Sea-Doo ride for you.
Some of them are larger, but in any event, the take-home message is that with the temperature in these areas, they can dry up really quickly. And toads lay their eggs in water. And if you've laid your eggs in a tiny little pond that could evaporate in a day or two, then it pays to hatch quickly, go through the tadpole stage, and get out of the pool as quickly as possible. And what has evolved in spadefoot toads is that in these instances, roughly half of the tadpoles that hatch out of a lump of eggs will suddenly explode in size, and they'll pull up these huge jaw muscles, and their intestines will get really short, like a carnivorous. Carnivores are a shorter intestine than an animal that eats plants, or like the algae eating brethren of these larger tadpoles, and they'll actually consume the smaller tadpoles. And that leads them to develop quicker. They can get out of the pond faster. They develop into little toadlets. Now it doesn't matter if that pond dries up, because some of them have gotten out, some of them have survived. You know, and that was one that blew me away. You know, I'd never heard anything like that. Come to learn that there were tiger salamanders do the same thing. And it's when you're in these environmental conditions that are completely non-predictable. And so this is a strategy that has evolved that enables some of the eggs to mature into first tadpoles, then, you know, young frogs or toads or salamanders. And I thought that was wild.
That's a fascinating example. If you try to extrapolate that scenario where environmental situations kind of lead to cannibalism, and you extrapolate that to, I guess, more sophisticated animals or bigger animals, and then ultimately to humans, is that the same kind of evolutionary circumstances that you view leading to the most common causes of cannibalism? And I don't want to say higher order species, because I know that's offensive or the wrong thing to say, but you know what I mean.
You mean in humans?
In humans, yeah.
We're a part of nature, not apart from nature. But I don't, first of all, to clear this up, I don't think there's a cannibalism gene. I don't think that there's something innate in us that makes us consume, want to, or desire to consume our own kind. What we do have is this we want to survive, and in very, very difficult conditions, which in most cases of human cannibalism, it is a matter of when you have reached the deepest depths of starvation and you get the opportunity to consume something, if it happens to be a dead person, then you are either going to choose to do it or you're going to choose to die. And so I think that that's, you know, that's the essence of what you might be getting at. These are, you know, this is the Donner Party. These are the rugby players that got stranded in the Andes. This is, you know, this is Leningrad during World War II, where you have massive deaths, primarily from starvation. Or in the Donner Party, it was, you know, 35 people died. But you are, and there are these bodies laying around, and you are either going to consume them or you will starve to death. And so that's what happens in these instances of starvation cannibalism. But I don't think that we have a cannibalism gene or anything of that manner.
But the way you describe that really fits with what you said earlier, just in terms of kind of environmental situations can lead to it. And that's kind of an evolutionary instinct. So it might not be a gene, but nothing innate to humans, but that same thing that has propelled evolution, from what I'm gathering, that causes different species to want to survive. That's what ultimately can lead to cannibalism in situations where survival is at risk.
Yeah, but I don't think there's a choice involved with say a tadpole, which is, you know, it's a crapshoot. Is this tadpole going to have the genetic makeup that causes it to become this larger cannibalistic morph, or a little, you know, a little algae nibbler? There's no choice involved. Whereas, you know, there were people in the Donner Party who starved to death. They chose not to consume other humans, and that's the case in these types of survival scenarios. You know, there's a new movie out now, and I haven't seen it yet. But
Society of the Snow.
Yeah, I think that what came out of that story was that you know, there were some people who would not consume the meat from the bodies of their dead friends and sometimes relatives. In other instances, they chose to do that.
That's a really illustrative distinction, though, that you're saying there is kind of that genetic aspect in that tadpole example, whereas it's a different motivation, more of a conscious decision, even if it is in the name of survival in humans, but they're distinct.
Cannibal, listen, culture is king, and it depends on what you are taught as far as what's normal behavior. And if you're taught that consuming your dead rather than burying them is the right thing to do, to honor them, to incorporate a part of them into you. And then when people who move in, you know, and plant a flag and say, wait a minute, you're supposed to be burying your dead. You're like, what? What do you mean? Why would you put your dead in the ground and let them be eaten by worms? You know, why wouldn't you want to? So that turned into like a huge mess when, you know, these colonial flag planters went around the world and encountered indigenous people who had beliefs and culture that and religious rites that were, you know, millennia old, and they were used to doing this sort of thing. And I think that's certainly the case with in some instances with cannibalism, where if you're not from the West with this sort of ingrained thing that we have, that cannibalism is quite possibly the worst taboo that you could inflict on another person, that and you didn't get that memo, then you could have a completely different way of dealing with consuming another human.
And that's kind of what my favorite element of this podcast is about Preconceived. Sometimes if you think about it, if you lived in a vacuum, which sometimes I think is a useful ideology to have, and you weren't exposed to the views of the outside world, what would you do? And you're saying in some civilizations, before they encountered Western influences, that was just normal. Why wouldn't you? Because it's food. And there might actually be nothing abnormal about that mindset. It's just a different mindset than the Western mindset, which dominates a lot of worldviews today.
Yes, exactly right. And the point that I tried to make in this book was that once the West moved into these regions, and I think I use the Caribbean as an example, and they saw that there was ritual cannibalism taking place, that they were able to use that label of cannibal as a bludgeon and as a way to dehumanize the people that they met were no longer people. They were vermin. They were either going to be enslaved or annihilated. And this was you know, this was done commonly, and it was done by Columbus, and it was done by a number of Western so-called explorers, where, because there is this knee-jerk reaction that we have in the West to cannibalism. You know, they must be subhumans. You know, Queen Isabella, in not so many words, told Columbus.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, if these people are not cannibals, I want you to bring them into the fold, make them good Christians. But if they're cannibals, you can do whatever you want with them. All bets are off. And that's what he did. When he couldn't find gold, he found the next best thing, which was, you know, slaves. And so that's where that all came from. Now, there was no gold in the Caribbean. And when none was found, he went, well, I've got to finance these trips. And there were four of them. And by the third and fourth trip, it was more like a, you know, it was more like an invasion than an exploration.
And of course, in addition to the visceral reaction that I think a lot of the Europeans had, the Spanish and the Portuguese, when they went to North America and saw these practices, that this was just so abnormal to them, there was also a politicization that was useful for them to say, how are we going to ethically, morally say that this is okay to conquer these territories? And one of them is, well, these people are savages, they're cannibals, and that word alone is enough to justify a lot of things.
Absolutely.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. When we talk about some of the more popular examples in pop culture, which you alluded to, so the Uruguayan plane crash in the Andes that happened, I think it was in the 70s, maybe the 80s. And that was a case where there was a plane crash of a sports team and there were some survivors. It's an incredible story that's documented in the book Alive and in some movies as well. And it talks about how they all did end up resorting to cannibalism in terms of eating the bodies of the fellow passengers, many of whom they'd known who had died. And I guess it's shocking, but not shocking, that when they returned to civilization, they got heat for it. Now, they had been through trauma people can't even imagine. I've read the book Alive, and I would recommend people reading it if they're interested in this topic. But people viewed this as, I know you needed to survive, but how on earth could you do that? Does that surprise you? Is it naive that people were shocked, not just shocked and surprised, but condemning to an extent what was done? When you think about what other choice did they have?
Yeah, great question and really interesting topic. And the thing that I read that I'd never known about this group before was that a couple of them became very successful. And there was this sort of stigma about what they had done, even though they did it to survive, that they carried around this stigma until one of these guys, and I believe he became a lawyer, came out in an interview and said that, you know, when we consumed the bodies of our friends, we thought about Jesus Christ and consuming how during communion,
the sacrament,
body, right? And so at that point, the Archbishop of Montevideo supposedly gave his okay and his blessing to what had taken place, and then all, you know, everybody was all right.
Yeah, that's in the book, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds of it because I don't want to ruin it for people and they might not be familiar, but that was such an interesting way that it was once again kind of justified as, well, if you're going to frame it as this is actually okay because this represents some element of Christianity, okay, we can get behind this. But initially, until they made that connection, which I don't think they were fabricating, it sounded genuine, it was viewed with a lot more contempt. I'm curious, from an evolutionary standpoint, if it's related, do we know how the human body responds to eating human flesh? Because that could give potentially an answer to some people who are asking, is this quote unquote natural, which is a tough definition to even have.
Yeah, I really don't think that there's any that there's any difference between, as far as the body is concerned. I mean, if you could sort of take out the fact that you're horrified that you're consuming another human, if you can get past that physiologically, I don't think that there's anything at all different between consuming, let's say, a muscle from a cow and the equivalent muscle from a human. Now, there are some real problems, and those have to do with from looking at it from a sort of evolutionary standpoint, and there are problems with consuming your own. And this goes, I'll just use the example for humans. There's this thing called inclusive fitness, which means that if you have a population, then it doesn't make evolutionary sense for you to be eating and killing and eating members of that own your own population. The one that is most important, I think, is that there are diseases like kuru and mad cow disease that are come into play when you eat your own species, and so that is something that I think is extremely important, and one reason why, you know, you'd never condone that you might want to condone cannibalism. You know, there were the foray in New Guinea were consuming their dead, and these were people who were desperately ill with a horrible neurodegenerative disease, kuru, and they were succumbing to this disease by consumption of nervous tissue of their fellows, their relatives and friends.
And kuru is mad cow disease.
Yeah, it depends on what side of the boat you're on. You know, when I came into this thing, I thought, oh, it's prions. There are these sort of like self-replicating proteins that they're the cause of this. They're involved with Alzheimer's disease. They're what produces these proteinaceous plaques in the brains of people who have Alzheimer's disease. And then what I learned and what still blows me away is that there's another side to that story that gets less airplay, mainly because probably it was either two or three. I think it's two people, won Nobel prizes for their work on prions or work that they ripped off other people work on prions. But there is just as strong an argument that prions don't exist, that there's no such thing as a self-replicating protein, that this is a virus. I mean, I guess the common term for it would be a slow virus, and that this virus, that the body's reaction to it is to produce these proteinaceous plaques. That and so Alzheimer's disease and mad cow disease and kuru, they're all diseases that are caused by the body's sort of overblown reaction to this viral invader. And when I went into the book, I'd heard nothing about that, and I spoke to scientists who thoroughly convinced me that this is still an open topic, that you know, it hasn't, in at least in my book and for other people as well, hasn't necessarily been decided.
Bill, there's a few other really interesting motivations of human cannibalism that you mention in your book. One is this idea of medicinal cannibalism that was witnessed in European and Chinese rulers, ancient Egyptian mummies, mothers eating placentas even. Could you talk to me a bit about some of that?
Yeah, that, as I mentioned before, there were two big surprises that came out of this book. For me, on the animal kingdom side, it was just how prevalent cannibalism was for all sorts of different reasons, all of them very natural. And on the human side of it, it was with cannibalism being this massive, you know, this horrible taboo that for hundreds of years in Europe and elsewhere, body parts were eaten regularly by the rich, by the poor, to cure every type of disease. They ate every part of the body that you can imagine for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that really threw me for a loop. And I think what remains of that is this placentophagy, the idea that a mother who consumes her own placenta is going to get a health benefit out of it, something about replacing lost hormones, curing the baby blues, that sort of thing.
Any evidence for that?
None. But the placebo effect is very, very, very strong. And the people that I work with, I was just finishing up this book and I was just about to start teaching, and I got a phone call from a woman in Plano, Texas. I'd been sort of putting out feelers to investigate this idea of the concept of consuming your own placenta. And this woman gave me a call, and I started talking to her, and I thought I was going to do an interview. And she goes, "Well, you should come on down to Plano, and you could eat my placenta." And I went like, "What?" I'm thinking to myself, "Did this woman just invite me down to Texas to eat her placenta?" And she was like, "Yeah, I just had a baby. It's in the freezer. You can have, my husband's a chef. We can make it asabuco. You can make it into a taco, however you want it."
Oh, and my God.
Yeah. So I'm like stunned. So I go home and I tell my wife, and I'm like, you know something?
We're going to Texas.
it was not quite that quick. But if it's 10 years from now, I've written a book about cannibalism. I had the chance to do this, but I didn't. I'd be kicking myself in the behind. So I went. I got tickets immediately. I went down there. I interviewed her first. It's one of the last chapters in the book. It's called Placenta Helper. I also write fiction, and I could not have written this as a fiction story to make it any more weird or any more wonderful, because the family that I went down and visited were amazingly cool. But when I did my initial interview with her, she as much as admitted that it was pretty much the placebo effect, and she referenced a study that had been done that was pretty much disproven. I didn't really want to jump on her about it, but she's convinced that for whatever reason, and she does admit that the placebo effect is very strong, her clients feel better, and that's all that matters. But if you think about it, if you think you're replacing hormones, and a hormone is a type of protein, if you're cooking this, you're denaturing the protein, just mm-hmm. like you would nature the protein in an egg if you were to fry it. It's just not the same thing that you started with.
Yeah, when you denature the protein is no longer the protein that you were intending on having.
That's right. And it's the same for the hormones that you're trying to replace. But this is sort of the last vestige of that medicinal cannibalism that you brought up, that was extremely widespread, and prisoners and the recently interred or people that got hung, they were oftentimes utilized, their bodies were utilized for medicinal purposes. There were tinctures made. They made powders out of them. They salves to rub on their bodies, mummies which came from a mistranslation. The word mumia in Arabic is this tarry, bitumeny stuff. And there was a mistranslation there that the Arabs, when they were ruled Egypt I think it was the 16th century, somehow they were involved. They thought that mummies, Egyptian mummies, that there was some medicinal value, that they used to coat the mummies with tar, but they didn't. And when the Europeans and the Americans heard that word mumia, they thought mummy. And so, there's medicinal value in mummy. And so mummies became, they became a sort of a black market in mummies to grind them up and to utilize them as medicine. And it was still, mumia was still on sale in the early 20th century. It's in the Merck catalog in like 1913.
Wow. People looking for some mumia on the black market. Was delicacy one of them that was in your book?
There were some cultures that considered human flesh a delicacy, and that was so in order to look that stuff up, I had to find a place where that did not, this taboo, Western taboo and cannibalism started with the ancient Greeks and then moved to the Romans and then sort of spread out into literature through people like Shakespeare and Sigmund Freud and Daniel Defoe. And, it just steamrolled. And that's really where we got our ideas about cannibalism is the worst thing that you could do, because it was either incredible vengeance, the worst, or something that monsters would do to you, or gods if they were really PO'd. So I tried to, in order to sort of substantiate that, I went to look at places that didn't, that weren't really reading the ancient Romans, and they weren't reading Western literature, and the one that wrote the most about it was China. Now, that's not to say that there were not other cultures that didn't really have a lot of contact, at least initially with the West, that there weren't other cultures where cannibalism was not a part of the sort of, you know, their culinary background. But the Chinese really wrote about it extensively. So there's a lot of written evidence that humans were eaten because they tasted good, and children were supposedly tastier and more tender than next would be women, who had this kind of subcutaneous fat that the men didn't have. And after a battle, prisoners were consumed. It was, you know, it was something that took place for reasons that didn't have to do with starvation or honoring the dead. In both of those instances, that took place in China as well. But this culinary cannibalism was something that was, you know, that was not something that I thought that I'd run into. So to me, it was sort of a surprise that there were actual cookbooks and pretty vast documentation about preparing the human body.
Wow. So in this culinary cannibalism, as you call it, in those situations, there were instances of intent of, I don't know, murder or killing for the intention of, we want to eat that meat. It wasn't just bodies that had already been deceased.
Yeah. I mean, well, murder is murder. Look, if you go into these starvation conditions, like in Russia during World War II, and
Leningrad.
And Leningrad is encircled, and these people are starving to death, and it's sub-zero weather. There were murders going on where people were murdered and fresh, you know, their bodies were chopped up and sold on markets as, you know, as dog meat or cat meat or but there were murders as well. So I guess the point I'm making is not that the only murders, you know, that relate to cannibalism were because of culinary cannibalism. That just wasn't the case. You know, there was criminal cannibalism. There was, you know, there was cannibalism because of starvation, and people were, you know, saw that there was meat on the market and bought it, and didn't think twice about what it might be.
Bill, such an interesting, unique topic that not many people know tons about. And it's been a delight having you here. Are there any messages or final words you want to impart to somebody about cannibalism when they are thinking about it? Maybe a preconception or something that you've really learned that you like to impart to people that they take away from this topic?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and thanks for allowing me to make it. I really do think that when we think of cannibalism, we think about the sensationalized aspects of it, and I just want, you know, as a zoologist and as somebody who studied this type of thing, I think that there are other cannibalism related topics out there that are quite natural and have nothing to do with Jeffrey Dahmer or, you know, somebody deciding to make a big splash on social media by talking about the fact that, you know, he considers cannibalism to be something cool. You know, it's way more interesting than that, and there's a lot to investigate and a lot to learn if you're into that sort of thing, and not all of it is blood and guts.
Well, Bill Shutt, the author of Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. You can look that up on Amazon, or you can go to his website, billshutt.com. And you've also got a new book called Bite, An Incisive History of Teeth from Hagfish to Humans. Do you want to speak briefly about what that's about?
The way that bite is laid out is sort of similar to the way that Cannibalism or Pump, my most recent book on the heart, is laid out, where I move through the animal kingdom first and then transition into humans. And so that's really the same thing that I've done with teeth. And I guess my argument there is that teeth are really one of the top things that are responsible for the success of backboned animals. And so there are a lot of interesting examples there. I get to go into some neat human examples, like George Washington's dentures. You know, there was recently some real controversy about the fact that the teeth in his dentures might have come from enslaved people. And so I went in and investigated that. So it was a lot of fun. It was in some ways reminiscent of cannibalism.
Come from enslaved people? What was the conclusion?
Well, I'm not telling anybody.
Okay. All right. People, go check out Bite and find out, go check out the answer to that question. Cause that's fascinating. And you mentioned earlier that you are very lucky to be doing the work you do, but And you are, but it sounds like you've created a lot of that luck by pursuing such interesting projects that you're clearly so passionate about. And I'm so, so grateful that we finally synced up so you could join me for this episode.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here. I'm really glad this worked out. I wish you a lot of success with your podcast.
Thank you. For Bill Shutt, I'm Zale Mednick, and thank you for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
A little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.